From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
El Cerrito,
Union Square,
San Francisco,
South of Market,
from Albany,
Hayes Valley,
Rockridge in Oakland.
I'm from the Civic Center. I live across the street.
Coming up, we'll see how one San Mateo County resident is handling cuts to her food stamp benefits.
If I can find a whole bunch of Top Ramen packets instead of bananas and apples, then I'll have to do that until I can eat less if I have to, instead of eating so much.
We'll also explore how creativity can feed our spirit.
I hate to say, this sounds really kind of funny, but I think art and dance and culture is a part of our soul.
And we'll search for a violin soul with one of the Bay Area's busiest luthiers.
In the right hands, sound will come out of there that touches people too.
Tune in for Cross Currents. What if your entire monthly food budget was under $200? How would that change your shopping habits? That's the reality for a growing number of Americans who rely on food stamps. In February, the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, was cut by $8.6 billion over the next decade, reducing both the amount of money available to SNAP beneficiaries and the number of people who qualify for the program. In this story from our archives, KALW's Angela Johnston went grocery shopping in San Mateo County to get a sense of what these cuts really mean for one woman expecting a child.
So right now we are inside my favorite store, Grocery Outlet. Well, this is the wine section. I don't shop here. I don't know anything about that.
For Jamise Payne, the grocery store is a math problem. She's got a baby boy on the way, so she says she's shopping and eating for two. She walks up and down the aisles of the Redwood City Grocery Outlet, adding and subtracting prices in her head.
So this bread was $2.99. I love math. I do 10% whenever I saw that I could budget so that I don't go over. Like I said, I do my little $50 a week thing. Probably going to just do 40 for now since I have a little food at home and the whole budget cut kind of slowing me down a little bit.
Payne is strict about buying food because she's using CalFresh benefits, better known as food stamps. She joined the program after she ran away from home. She was 17.
Food money was a little hard for me. And a friend of mine, told me, don't be so proud to go to the welfare office and go get food stamps. I had no idea what it was, but I didn't like the idea of getting help from the government. But I did it.
Now she gets $50 a week to spend on food, and it makes her life a lot easier.
My stomach was gargling and grumbling every other day, so I was very happy to actually have some food in my stomach.
Back in 2009, the year before Payne applied for CalFresh, President Obama temporarily increased the amount of federal money for state food stamp programs. Americans were still feeling the effects of the recession, and the president felt they needed a boost. But on November 1st of this year, that increase expired. Payne noticed the change in her very next check.
It was a lot less than what I originally got, and I was wondering, wait, what happened to it? I'm on a plan, like my $50 a week plan, to make that work, and I have to kind of rearrange that.
So that's what she does, even if it means skipping out on healthy meals.
With less money, it's going to make me have to just work with whatever lasts longer, whatever. And if I can find a whole bunch of Top Ramen packets instead of bananas and apples, then I'll have to do that until I can eat less if I have to, instead of eating so much.
There is no average recipient of food stamps. There are people like Payne who work multiple jobs. Others are unemployed, elderly, or immigrants. The one thing that ties all these people together is their income. More than 90% of food stamp benefits go to households below the poverty line. Altogether, the cuts have affected more than 47 million people. One in every seven Americans.
When you think about a 5% reduction in your grocery allocation, something goes away.
Beverly Beasley Johnson is the director of human services in San Mateo County. It's the agency that distributes CalFresh benefits and the place where Payne first went for help.
So you open your browser and you type in SMC-Connect, and immediately will pop up the I Need screen.
We're in her office, and Johnson is showing me one of the county's newest resources, a simple website that helps people find food and other services. She says it was designed to cut through a lot of the red tape that surrounds food stamps.
We're currently serving in San Mateo County about 30,000 residents, but we believe that there are another 20,000 residents who are food insecure, who in fact may be hungry, and who are not accessing the program for a variety of reasons.
San Mateo County, like the rest of the Bay Area, presents people with a unique challenge. It's one of the most expensive places you can live, but the benefits aren't any higher than they are anywhere else in the country.
Eligibility for CalFresh in San Mateo County is exactly the same as it would be in Mississippi.
So a family of four in East Palo Alto may make too much money to qualify, even if they're struggling to make ends meet because of the high cost of living.
In my world, San Mateo would see something that really reflected the difference in the cost to live in this community.
We've got an 8,000-square-foot cooler. So you saw squash there. We won't keep you in here very long.
Kathy Jackson is the CEO of Second Harvest Food Bank. The organization provides food to more than 250,000 people each month in Santa Clara and San Mateo counties. Many of the people who use Second Harvest also rely on food stamps.
We're not meeting the local need. To think about that local need possibly doubling, there's just not any way in the world that we could meet that. So we will do the best that we can.
I wanted $40 today. And I extremely overpriced all these items, so I'm sure it'll be cheaper than that too.
Back in the grocery outlet checkout aisle, Jamise Payne is happy as she watches her bill come in way under budget.
$18.98, okay, you're using staffer, okay.
Tonight, she'll make strawberry shortcake with some berries she bought today and a cake she got from a food bank. It's a treat for herself, an indulgence she won't allow after the baby arrives, and she takes maternity leave from her two jobs. She's already thinking well into the future.
As he gets older, as he wants to explore grabbing food off my plate, I was a little worried thinking about it. I don't know if I'll be on it. Maybe. Hopefully I'll be in a better situation. I won't have to worry about food stamps ever. But if that time does come and I'm still on food stamps and the budget, drink more, maybe that'll help buy a lot more water instead of food.
No matter what, she says, she'll find a way to make it work. In Redwood City, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
Jamise Payne gave birth to a healthy baby boy in December of 2013, a week after that story first aired. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Around the Bay Area, there are a number of studios where adults with disabilities use art to express themselves. One of them is Creativity Explored. It's a thriving studio and art gallery in San Francisco where about 130 artists with developmental disabilities make, show, and sell their work to more than 10,000 visitors a year. Amy Taub is executive director of Creativity Explored.
It's not necessarily what's being expressed, it's how it's being expressed, and it's become a vehicle for people to develop relationships with a very, very broad community that they really would not have had.
KALW's Julie Kane visited the Creativity Explored studio, and she brings us this story.
I'm sitting at a table with Walter Kresnick and Quentin Rodriguez. They're bent over big sheets of paper with pencils and markers and paint.
You guys are both making hearts?
Yeah. Uh-huh. He's making hearts too.
You're making small versions.
I'm making small, big ones.
We're not talking about the kind of puffy, stylized hearts most at home on Valentine cards or sailors' arms. These are the real deal. Anatomically correct hearts, complete with valves and chambers and...
That's the veins.
Oh, that's the...
That's the anterior view of the heart.
Yeah, that's the veins.
The room we're in is an open space, the size of several classrooms put together. It's full of color and light and activity. Artwork covers the walls and hangs from clotheslines strung up above tables crowded with working artists.
We start early in the morning and then we're really creative. Like, we think of a thought of what we want to draw, and we don't copy. We just go for what, you know, people will like it and enjoy it. And it gives us joy.
That's Kevin Roach. He's been making art here for almost 10 years. And right now, he's working on an incredibly intricate drawing of ants. Lots of ants. Each one is outlined in black Sharpie and then colored in with red.
This looks like a lot of work, what you're doing here. How long have you been working on this?
Maybe 3 weeks. We don't rush anything. We like to keep things kind of going, but, you know, make it really kind of beautiful.
And why ants?
Because they're real, and they're a part of our world.
Real and part of our world. That's a pretty good description of what it feels like here, and what Creativity Explored is all about. Visitors are welcomed, and the doors to the studio are wide open.
The really, really important thing in all of our lives is human connection. It's that very, very simple moment when you look into somebody's eyes and you say hello. And that happens on a daily basis here.
Amy Taub has been the executive director at Creativity Explored for 15 years. She says the artists here come from all walks of life. Some have intellectual disabilities, some are on the autism spectrum, some have cerebral palsy, but here they're not defined by their disability. They're artists whose work is collected and exhibited and sold.
In the Bay Area, there's been a real value placed on people's creativity and ways to communicate, and that stemming from the strong belief that all people have something to say.
One of the teachers here is Victor Cartagena. He's a Salvadoran-born artist who's been working in the Bay Area since the 1980s. It's his table where the drawings of ants and hearts are happening.
And I teach what I do in my profession, you know, the way I do my work, that's the way I can just guide them. You know, it's that easy way I can just introduce a new way of seeing it with the simplicity, line, and way of thinking.
Cartagena leans in to look at Walter Kresnik's anatomically correct hearts and gives him a big smile.
Walter tends to do repetition, but every single heart is totally different shape, different size, but it's coming from the same idea.
The hearts represent people who are special to Kresnik. Cartagena asks him who they are and then carefully starts to write the names next to the hearts.
B-I-A?
Bia.
Yeah.
Oh, that's okay.
Right.
Okay. Who else?
At the other end of the table, Kevin Roach takes a break from his drawing, which is now covered with even more ants.
Are you ever surprised at the art you make?
Oh, my God. I am. I'm really shocked. I'm shocked. Sometimes I'm shocked at that I even did it.
And that's when I notice what's at the center of each one, a little heart. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.
KALW's Ryan Miller also contributed to that story. And if you want to meet some of the artists and see their work, now is a very good time for that. Creativity Explored is holding its annual holiday art sale now through December 30th. For more information, go to kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Roland Feller can't play the violin, but he's a world-renowned luthier. That's someone who makes and repairs violins. If you were to walk into his tiny workspace on Divisadero Street in San Francisco, you might find him chatting with musicians from the San Francisco Symphony, advising young players on which instrument to purchase, or even doing emergency fixes for greats like Anna-Sophie Mutter or Itzhak Perlman. For more than three decades, he's been San Francisco's resident violin whisperer, the unseen master who plays a big part in keeping San Francisco's stringed instruments in perfect working order. KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs visited his shop to see how he gives a violin its voice.
When you imagine Roland Feller working on a violin, picture him seated at a tiny old-fashioned desk littered with tools and wood shavings, in a room piled with sheet music, billing forms, and of course, violins. Violins hanging on the walls and from the ceiling, violins leaning against the table legs on the floor.
Okay, just so you know what these sounds are going to be, this violin came in because the bridge had fallen down. It was stored someplace where it was near a heater. And as they were trying to string it back up again, the sound post inside the instrument, you can hear it rattling around inside right now. Doesn't do any good that way.
Feller is responsible for the well-being of many of the city's stringed instruments. His walls are coated with signed autographs of thankful celebrities. His phone rings constantly.
Good morning, this is Ron Feller.
But for him,
sitting on my bench working on an instrument, that's my favorite part.
The sound post he's fixing is one of the most important parts of the violin.
It's so important that in Italian, actually, they call that the soul of the instrument.
Yes, a soul. There's something about the quality of a violin's sound. It's dynamic and energetic. It can express anything from pure, unfettered joy to wretched despair. You'll hear violin in classical music, in bluegrass, in jazz, in Eastern music, even in some dance floor hits. Energetic, adaptable, expressive, the violin feels alive. And that's probably why when people talk about it, they often don't talk about its sound. They talk about its voice.
Just like with humans, there are different voices. I mean, they're all the same pitch, but the voice characteristic can vary quite a bit. So as a violin maker, what you're trying to achieve is to both have something that is beautiful, aesthetically speaking, that talks back to you, but you also want to be able to hear it in the right hands. Sound will come out of there that touches people too.
Achieving that combination of beautiful aesthetic and beautiful sound is difficult.
To make a really fine violin, you have to have good materials. In most cases, it is maple that's being used for the back, sides, and scroll. Then we also use ebony or rosewood for fittings, and the top is generally spruce.
The better the quality of wood, the more likely the instrument will age well. And then there are the strings. Today, they're often made out of synthetic materials like nylon or Kevlar, but it wasn't always that way.
Traditionally, strings used to be made of gut, sheep gut, generally. If you can imagine having a string made of gut, if it gets a little bit moist from perspiration from the player, or you go from a foggy day outside into a heated room inside, those materials will react to humidity changes.
The violin may be a beautiful instrument, but nobody said it wasn't a finicky one. Other than the strings, the violin is pretty much made exactly the same way as it has been for centuries. The instrument was first created in the mid-16th century by a man named Andrea Amati in an Italian town called Cremona. Amati passed down his knowledge to his son Girolamo, who passed it down to his son Niccolo, who passed it on to people like Antonio Stradivari.
He didn't just make the same violin again and again and again. He did a lot of experimenting and in some ways kind of set standards that we still use to this day.
Chances are you've probably heard of the famed Strads. About 500 of his violins still exist today. These instruments are worth insane amounts of money. In 2011, a violin named Lady Blunt, and yes, violins generally do have names, sold for $15.9 million. Feller's first mentor was a man by the name of Simone Fernando Sacconi, considered by many to be the premier luthier of the 20th century. He's who taught Feller how to build a Strad model violin.
With him teaching me that, I made a Strad model violin to the best of my ability. And finally the point came where I finished it and I strung it up and played a few notes, and I was so disappointed. I thought, my gosh, after all this, that's all the sound that's coming out of this? It's kind of disappointing.
Okay, before you get too crestfallen on Feller's behalf, there's something you should know about new violins, or really any violin that hasn't been played in a while.
The instrument needs a little time to get used to the tension of the strings again, and then also needs to get used again to vibrate, thereby creating the sound. So as the instrument gets played for a while, everything kind of falls in place, if you will, and as time goes by, it will start sounding better and better.
So Feller handed his model Strad off to a violinist to play.
And within that first hour already, I could tell the instrument started to come alive.
And this is what his violin sounds like today. When Feller talks about this violin, or really any instrument he's worked on, he speaks as if remembering an old friend. You can really hear in his voice the affection and respect he has for each one. He clearly thinks of the violin as this living, breathing thing. Something with a soul. For Cross Currents, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs.
And a special thanks to Patrick Galvin for playing Roland Feller's violin so beautifully. For more local stories, go to kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Julie Kane, Jen Chien, Audrey Dilling, Seth Samuel, Nina Gensler-Debs, Liz Mack, Daphne Matsiaraki, Mary Reese, Judy Silber, and Rachel Wong. Today's show was produced by Ashley Ann Krigbaum and engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And we can proudly say that we are listener-supported public radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.